man. And he was like, you sound like a character from a cartoon show.
Well, now I'm going to have to watch to find out which...
Yeah, let me know.
Which animal you are.
Okay, let me know.
I think you're the monkey.
Call us at 201-209-9368. What's the weirdest thing someone has said to you before sex? This is Shut Up Weirdo on WFMU. What? You can come to our record fair next weekend. Starts Friday and Sunday at the Metropolitan Pavilion. What street is it on, Andy?
18th Street.
18th Street near 6th Avenue. I'll be there. Andy and I are doing the Wheel of Fate on Sunday between 12 and 4.
I believe it's 12:30 and 4:30.
12:30 and 4:30. So if you'd like to meet us, we'll be right there in the front taking your money.
125
West. And I'll be drunk.
125 West 18th Street. I think this is from last year.
It's the same place every year.
No, no, this the bands that are going to be there.
Oh. FMU, you're on the radio.
Oh, Prince Rama.
Hi.
Hello.
I just tuned in, and I don't know what the question is, but I did hear about that whole Dora the Explorer thing, and the person he was talking about, or the character, was Benny the Bull.
Benny the Bull.
Do I sound like that person?
Oh, man. I guess with the oh, man.
I said, oh, man, and he said I sounded like him.
Oh, well, that's cool. That's what I called to tell you.
Thanks, so. Do you have a crush on me now?
Now you have your Halloween costume.
Yeah, now I have my Halloween costume. I'm not doing Halloween this year. Oops. Okay, thanks for calling. Have a good one. I'm over this. Is it over? I need to pee.
You're sitting here, like, you're taking your long hair and putting across your face like you're Salvador Dali.
Yeah, you got all a this, problem like, with weird, that?
Yeah, I got a big problem with that.
Why? Don't be jelly.
I wish I could grow a beard like that, a mustache like that. Big handlebar mustache.
FMU, you're on the radio.
Not Benny the Bull, it's Swiper.
Okay, well, Swiper? Okay, come on.
Ooh,
which
controversy.
Which one says, oh, man? FMU, you're on the radio.
With an oh, man here and an oh, man there. Here. And yes,
hello?
I'm sorry. Yes, we're on the air.
Hey, how you doing? It's Josh Top, pizza delivery guy.
Hi, Josh.
How are you doing, Frangry?
I'm fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I'm all right. If it wasn't working.
Good to hear.
So I got a funny quirk, I guess. It's completely normal to me, and that's why I do it, but I think people think it's weird. So I have this hobby of collecting all kinds of exotic animals, mainly reptiles and insects, a lot of tarantulas, scorpions, millipedes, cockroaches and stick bugs, and like I said, all kinds of reptiles too, snakes and lizards. And when I have something that dies, or someone else I know has something that dies, what I do is I like to save them, preserve them in alcohol in jars.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of times I won't have jars at the time or not have enough rubbing alcohol to preserve them in, so I save them in my freezer. And so now it gets to the point where my freezer is stockpiled with frozen alligators and snakes and tarantulas and turtles and frogs. And, you know, but I don't exactly know what I'm going to do with them, when I'm going to do something with them, what I'm going to do with them once they're in the jars. It's kind of just a collection, I guess. So I've got half my freezer is frozen pizza and meat and vegetables, and the other half is frozen exotic animals.
No popsicles?
You should make a stew.
Excuse me?
She says she should make a stew of your dead animals.
Make a stew? It would be a very exotic stew. I guess we could do that.
I think you just need to be more selective in your collection, deciding, I don't need that many stick bugs. One will do.
More snakes and less of the insects?
Well, you know, the insects take up less space, I presume, than the snakes and alligators.
Well, you can do a main course and entrees and desserts.
Sure,
you know,
dessert.
Have a whole wide variety of all different things.
Yeah. I think we just solved your problem.
There you go. Well, is there something else we could sell? You know, we could probably fry some of this stuff up, package it, and you guys could sell that, give it away as the premium.
Yeah, and we helped you save on your grocery bill.
There you go.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Frank, anything you
want to
add?
I believe that's all.
Okay.
We'd like to thank Julie for pledging and Peter W. from Montclair.
Where's Julie from?
New York. Julie B.
Julie
our
B.
very own Julie B.
Or our very own Julie B.
201-209-9368. Tonight's topic is, what's the weirdest thing someone said to you before sex?
I think we have to... No, it's the old McDonald.
Oh,
quirkiness. Hey, I think we only have time for one more call.
We don't have any calls, so don't worry about it.
Oh, that works out well then.
My winner is Sarah. Email me your mailing address and t-shirt size at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org. And you can listen to my new advice show at 7:30 on wfmu.org. It's called I'm Worth It with Michelle and Frangry.
So that mean we don't have any more calls?
We have one. Should I get it?
Why don't you get it?
Hi, you're on the radio.
Hey, the weirdest thing someone said to me before sex was, help, police.
Not as good as
that. Wait, I was not supposed to laugh at that, right?
Okay, have a good one. I have to pee so bad. I'm going to die. FMU, you're on the radio. Make it quick.
Hi. The weirdest thing someone ever said to me before sex, what would your guru think about this?
Your guru? Pretty good. I like that.
That's what she said.
Okay, have a good one. Bye.
That's what she said.
All right, Sarah. Oh, that was funny.
It's not time for me to say.
Sarah, you know what to do.
Send us your email. Mailing address.
Honey.
Send us your email us at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org with your mailing address and t-shirt size.
Yes. Go ahead, Andy.
I was just about to say that you have been listening to Shut Up Weirdo here on WFMU. You can comment during the show, as many have, at WFMU.org. You can visit ShutUpWeirdo.com, our website, which has links to our Facebook page, our Twitter page, our iTunes archive.
It has and Andy's social security number, his address, his t-shirt size.
Up next is Stuff You Should Know. You're listening to WFMU.
You got it.
Okay, hold on. You're throwing me off my game. You are listening to WFMU, The Mindbender, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org. What else do we say at the end of the show, Frangri?
It's over.
No, we say, let's end it here.
It's time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that exposes the internal workings of life on this planet. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Josh and Chuck explore the circus arts, specifically sword swallowing, as well as face nailing. And then in part two, they take a look at lie detectors and how they work. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, which makes this Stuff You Should Know like you didn't know. And if this is your first time, if you really didn't know, welcome to the dark side. Your life is just forever changed. You are officially addicted.
That's right.
Yeah, that's what I got.
I'll take swords for 500, Trebek.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't that what you said when I suggested this one?
I typed it.
Yeah.
And I think you thought it was funnier when I typed it.
I heard it.
Okay.
I heard it in my head. It sounded much like that.
Daryl Hammond, Sean Connery.
Yeah. Chuck.
Yes.
Have you ever seen the movie Dazed and Confused?
Yeah. In fact, I remember the first time I saw that movie.
Oh, yeah? Let's hear it.
In Athens, at the Georgia Theater.
Mm. That was a great place to see that movie.
It was.
That was wonderful. Yeah. Remember whenever they showed, I think his name was Washington?
No.
No?
Which character?
The black guy.
I think you're thinking of the Sweat Hogs. That was Washington.
Right, but I think his name was Washington, too.
Oh, okay.
I think. I'm not sure. But yes, clearly, I could just be thinking of that guy because they both had froze and they were set in the 70s.
Right.
But he has that paddle and it says Soul Pole on it.
Yeah.
Do you remember the whole theater just erupting the first time it showed that?
Yeah.
Oh, it was awesome.
I remember I thought Matthew McConaughey was not an actor.
Oh, like he was really Wooderson.
I thought he was a real dude they just dug up in Texas.
Oh, yeah, because that was like the beginning of his career.
It's the first thing I ever saw him in.
And Ben Affleck.
Yeah.
And that was just a great movie.
Parker Posey.
Yeah, well, that brings me to my point.
Okay.
Parker Posey, you remember the part during the beer bust where Parker Posey's funneling beer through a beer bong.
Yeah.
And, like, she's got it for, like, a half a second, maybe a second and a half, and then, it just, like, pours out of her mouth and all over her face.
Yes.
At that moment, the first thing I thought of is I'm sure everybody thought as well when they saw that very suggestive part was Parker Posey would be terrible at sword swallowing.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. Because it takes a certain amount of relaxation to swallow a sword. And after researching
and
this article, I found that a sword swallower would make an excellent beer funneler.
I haven't funneled a beer in a long time.
It's been a while for me,
it's
too.
It's probably good when you're 40 to be able to say that.
I lost access to beer funnels. I think that's kind of what happens. Like, you just don't go to places where there's a beer funnel.
No, not anymore.
But you can always shotgun a beer as long as you have a pen and a beer can.
I never got into any of that, to be honest. Keg stands, all that silliness.
Keg stands I wasn't big on.
I was just like, I'll just drink it.
I don't prefer being upside down.
I've never done a keg stand.
Really?
Never.
It's really, you're like, you know what it feels like to be torn apart by a gang of angry toughs because there's like a couple of guys like holding
like
your ankles and you're, it's really kind of scary. You're on the edge there.
We don't recommend any of those things.
No.
And while we're at it, this is the ultimate COA. Please, anyone out there, never, ever, ever try to swallow a sword or anything. Except food, obviously, and beverage.
Right, but no food larger than the end of a football.
Yeah. Do not try this at home ever, ever, ever.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, Josh and Chuck officially think you're stupid if you try to swallow anything after listening to this.
Or if you participate in backyard wrestling.
Yes.
While we're at it.
Equally dangerous.
Yes.
All right, so Chuck, let's talk about sword swallowing. I'm excited about this one.
Kind of cool.
Yeah. This is part of our ongoing circus arts collection.
Have we already done one?
Human Cannonball.
Oh, okay. We got to get Tightrope in there, and then we're all set.
Well, we need to do, like, Freaks, too.
Yeah, just Sideshow Freaks.
Or maybe even, like, History of the Sideshow. That'd be pretty awesome.
Agreed.
All right, so what other kind of freaks would I have just been talking about?
I don't know. you know, the kind you meet on a Friday night.
Have you seen that movie, Freaks?
Oh, yeah. We've talked about that one.
All right. Yes, we have. So, Chuck, let's talk about the history of sword swallowing, shall we?
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to learn that it started out with sort of religious undertones, mm-hmm. or are they overtones?
I think sword swallowing is so ta-da that it would be an overtone.
An overtone?
Yeah, it's not very subtle.
Oh, yeah, early on in India, about 4,000 years ago, they kind of the same folks who were doing the firewalking and snake handling to sort of show their oneness with God, would swallow swords.
Yeah, like they were protected, and they would be like,
"Look what I can do!"
Yeah, I'm boastful.
Yeah,
fakirs is what they're called.
Fakir.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sword swallowing has been around for 4,000 years, and there's apparently still a tribe. Although I couldn't find the name of the tribe, but it's in the Indian state of Andhra Pradesh, and they apparently still pass down sword swallowing skills from father to son.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So we know where it came from, and we know it's ancient. It started in India, started to move around the Far East, the Mideast.
The typical path things would follow. China, Japan, Mideast, Europe, eventually.
Language, civilization.
Yeah.
It all just followed the same path as sword swallowing. It hit Japan and China in the 8th century AD. In Japan, it became part of Sangaku,
mm-hmm.
one of those two,
yeah,
which is basically like street performance, right? And then apparently it got picked up again later on in India, again, in the cradle of it, by the whirling dervishes.
The rebirth of sword swallowing?
Yes, the first one.
By the dervishes?
Right, the whirling dervish, a dervish is a beggar of the Sufi mystic order of monks. And they would kind of whip themselves into a frenzy, hence the term whirling dervish. And there's a specific order of dervishes called the Order of Rifais. Rifais? Man, my Indian's getting rusty. and they eat glass, walk on coals, swallow swords. Basically,
Jim Rose
the original. It's like a revival of the original reason people would swallow swords.
Okay.
Right?
I love it.
And then it comes to Europe, and as with all things that came to Europe from the outside, the Catholic Church persecuted anyone who could swallow a sword.
Man, fun killers back in the day.
But that was not enough to kill it. It was basically just a loss of enthusiasm by the public. By the 19th century in Europe, everybody's like, we've seen this before. We know what's going on. It's all an illusion, a trick, which we'll get to in a minute.
Right.
But then it hits America. And there's a guy from Madras, an Indian man named Sena Sama. And on November 24th, 1817, which will henceforth in the SYSK pantheon of dates be referred to as Sword Swallowing Day.
Yeah.
In New York City at St. John's Hall, for $1, adults could see the first person to ever swallow a sword in the United States.
And for a dollar?
For a dollar.
That's a lot of money back then.
I agreed, but this is a big deal. And you would think it would have taken off right then, but no, it wasn't until 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair that it became very popular in the U.S.
Yeah, I wonder what else was big that year. That wasn't the ice cream year, was it? No.
No, that was St. Louis.
St. Louis.
In 1903.
Okay, so pre-ice cream, of course, sword swallowers, you know. If ice cream had been around, people would be like, eh.
Right.
I'd rather just eat ice cream.
Right. This was the year that electricity was a big one.
Oh, 1893?
Yeah, that was the one that the Devil in the White City is set.
Oh, okay. I still haven't read that.
It's pretty good. Well, you can wait for the movie now.
Oh, is it coming out?
Apparently, Leo DiCaprio is playing the bad guy.
Of course he is.
Yes.
I don't know why I said that. He rarely plays bad guys.
Yeah, that's true.
You know?
Although, he wasn't that good of a guy in Shutter Island.
Well, we don't want to ruin that.
It doesn't matter.
Okay. it died out again in the 1950s because of, you know, it was on the carnival circuit, and mm-hmm. I guess all these newfangled rides sort of took away from the whole sideshow aspect. And then I love how this points out that the, you know, the internet and video games also helped kill sword swallowing.
Right.
Like, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that one had anything to do with the other.
It did. The internet and video games pretty much killed everything but the internet and video games and TV.
Yeah, but now you can research and watch sword swallowing on the internet. No?
That is gorgeous thinking, Chuck. Okay. I'm very impressed with that one. All right, so that's pretty much the history of sword swallowing. There's, I guess, toward the beginning of the 20th century when it became very popular in the U.S., there is also a lot of controversy over whether it was a trick or an illusion. And Harry Houdini himself said it's a trick. There's a trick to it. And he wrote in his very famous book, The Miracle Mongers, an expose, right?
Yeah.
That people who swallow swords first backstage swallow a metal sheath that they slide the sword into.
All right, I got to stop you here. You're still swallowing the thing that's just as long and it's made of metal.
I agree.
Okay.
And you're pretending like it's not in there. You're walking around talking.
I know. It seems easier just to learn to swallow this. I mean, it's not like, and we'll cover this. Actually, might as well go ahead and say it. The swords that they swallow aren't sharp-edged.
No.
They are still pointy, but it's not like they're swallowing razor blades.
I get the impression that they're pointy-ish.
Well, yeah. A dull point, I would say.
Yes.
But, I mean, that can't be much worse than the sheath, so.
Right. I think the sheath
think
is worse.
Yeah.
Maybe Houdini was being funny and Tracy Wilson missed that.
Maybe so.
She goes on to point out that the Encyclopedia Britannica says that it's a magic trick as well. And that it's not a, that it is some sort of illusion or hoax or fraud.
Mm-hmm.
But, really, apparently, the basis of sword swallowing is quite real. Like, the person is swallowing a sword.
Yeah.
Right? So let's... how? How do you do that?
Well, Josh, if you're going to talk about swallowing a sword, then we need to talk about swallowing. And if you're going to talk about swallowing, you got to talk about the GI tract.
Yes.
Not the GI Bill. The GI gastrointestinal tract. It's got a couple of types of muscle. It's got a skeletal muscle tissue and smooth muscle tissue,
mm-hmm.
little lubrication layer called mucosa,
mm-hmm.
and then skeletal muscle is involuntary. I'm sorry, voluntary.
Right.
And if you're talking about your upper GI, you're talking about your mouth, your pharynx, and your upper esophagus. The smooth muscle is involuntary, and they work in concert to help you swallow junk.
Right. So the top stuff is all voluntary. Like, you can move your tongue. You can.
Yeah, you start off doing it on purpose when you chew and swallow.
Right, but then it gets to a certain point past the, what is it, the upper esophageal sphincter?
Yeah.
That just cracks me up. Once it gets past that, which is kind of high up toward the top of the esophagus.
Yes.
Then it, like you said, it becomes all involuntary. It's automatic, which makes it very difficult to control anything that happens after that.
Yeah, specifically the your epiglottis goes into action because that keeps stuff from going down into your lungs,
right,
which you don't want.
Yeah,
bolus is food, is chewed food and saliva.
That's the best word ever.
Bolus.
Yeah,
B-O-L-U-S. And once you've done all the voluntary action, it does a pretty cool thing. It gets down to the part of your esophagus that has the smooth muscle, the involuntary muscle.
Yes.
And peristalsis takes over. And that's basically it just squeezes it down like an inch at a time.
Yeah, you know how your esophagus is ringed?
Yeah.
Right? Those rings are little bands of muscle, and then they squeeze just above the bolus.
And just shove it down there.
It down. Finally, it gets to the lower esophageal sphincter. And that opens.
Like, do you have to laugh every time you say sphincter?
That opens, and the bolus drops into the stomach to be digested and then eventually pooped out.
Yeah.
So that's what happens.
That's swallowing.
That's
food.
That's life.
That is
we
life.
We just described life.
the trick here, not trick, but on the way down, it passes by things like your trachea,
mm-hmm.
Your heart, your aorta.
Which I thought was part of the heart.
Well, it's the artery, the main artery that connects to the heart.
Yeah, and I saw the vena cava was also separate. That's the main vein.
Yeah.
Oh. That was unintentional
and
as
the diaphragm is the muscle that moves up and down, which allows us to breathe. And we say all this because the sword
is passing right through there.
Yeah, I mean, it takes the same path as your food does.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah. I
not
mean,
pretty much, exactly.
We have our ribs because we've got so many vital organs right there that they need extra protecting. And so we circumvent the ribs when we swallow swords and just go directly past all that stuff, all that soft tissue, right?
Yeah, but there's a difference, a big difference here. Swallowing food requires a lot of contraction of muscles. And what you want to do when you swallow a sword is you want to relax all those muscles, even the involuntary ones, which is... We'll get into how to do that in a minute here.
Okay.
But it's sort of the opposite of, even though it follows the same path, the muscles are doing things they shouldn't do, aren't trained to do at least.
Well, that's kind of the point of sword swallowing. Like if you, one of the reasons we warned you against sword swallowing is because you can't just swallow a sword the first time you try it.
No.
You could, but you would kill yourself.
Yes.
Sword swallowing actually takes a lot of practice and a lot of horrible, horrible practice too. You have to train your involuntary muscle to work voluntarily, right?
Yeah, or to not volunteer at all.
That's a great point. By relaxing.
Yeah.
So the voluntary stuff, and let's talk about this. This is, I guess now we've reached sword swallowing 101.
Yeah.
The first part is easy because it's all voluntary muscle. You move your tongue out of the way.
Yeah.
You open your throat.
Yeah.
You tilt your head back. You always see a sword swallower tilt his head back. It's intuitive, but at the same time, the reason why is because they're lining up the pharynx, the throat,
mm-hmm.
with the esophagus so that it's a straight shot.
As straight as possible.
From the mouth all the way down, right?
That's right.
And then after that, Chuck?
Well, you slip the sword down in there, and it passes through the mouth and pharynx and upper esophageal sphincter into the esophagus itself. And the esophagus has got a little curve to it, so the sword is actually going to straighten it out. And Tracy even points out that sometimes it's nudging organs out of the way as well,
yeah,
on the way down.
That's why you usually swallow a sword slowly.
And the lubed sword as well.
Yeah.
Lubed either by saliva or artificially.
Right. Some people use petroleum jelly or vegetable oil or something.
Whatever your flavor is.
So that's how it's done. Pretty cool.
That's right.
That's pretty much all there is to it. But it takes some tremendous practice. And also, depending on the type of the sword or the length of the sword.
Yeah.
You said it was blunted. It's not sharp. Still kind of pointy.
Yeah.
But it's as dull as possible. But the length of the sword is also very important as well. Usually from your teeth to the cardia, which is where the stomach connects to the esophagus,
yeah,
where your lower esophageal sphincter is about 40 centimeters in the average person.
Yeah.
Okay?
That sounds about right.
So if you swallow a sword that's longer than 40 centimeters, you are going to, it's going to have to go into your stomach.
Yeah.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, and what I've gotten is most sword swallowers don't do that. It's not by accident that the Sword Swallowers Association International defines that length at 38 centimeters that, you know, to qualify. So if it's 40 centimeters, they said, let's make it a couple centimeters short.
Right, but this is just the typical person. It could be much shorter.
That's just to qualify. I don't know. I thought it had to be that long.
No, I'm saying your the distance cardia could be shorter. So
gotcha.
Even with that shorter sword, you still may be in your stomach. But yes, if you get it all the way down to a couple centimeters above your cardia, the SSAI, it still considers you a sword swallower, which I think is nice.
That is nice.
But Chuck, if you are taking a sword all the way down to your cardia, into your stomach. The sword is literally in your stomach.
That's crazy.
Not only have you relaxed like all the voluntary muscles in your mouth, you've relaxed all the voluntary muscles on your larynx and in your esophagus, right?
Yeah.
All the involuntary muscles. But you've also managed to figure out how to relax both of your esophageal sphincters, the top one and the one above your stomach,
I know.
So that you can pass a sword through without damaging it.
And without...
That.
Yeah.
Is nuts.
Yeah. And they do recommend, by the way, nothing over 24 inches, 61 centimeters, because at that point you are well into your stomach.
Yeah, that's the SSAI again.
Yeah, and I guess anything over that, you might go hit the bottom of the stomach, which you don't want to do.
Also, I want to point out that there is also a long tradition of sword swallowers who juggle and often do this on horseback while juggling.
Oh, dude, unicycles, cartwheels, they do all sorts of crazy things.
So really, to me, just standing stock still and swallowing a sword, that's impressive.
Have you ever seen The Drop?
No.
There's this, I don't know if it's a new move, but it's a move where you put it down like halfway, and then you move your hands, and you let it drop by itself.
Oh, wow.
And you actually tighten your, catch it with your esophageal muscles.
That is control.
Pretty good control.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they always take it out really quick, too, if you notice, because we'll talk about the gag reflex, but you're suspending that, and you can only do that for so long. That's why they, you know, you see them do it, and then it's like, ta-da, and they yank it back out really quickly.
Because they want to live.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of the gag reflex, that's one of the things that has to be overcome in training.
Yeah, let's get into the reflex thing.
Okay, well, reflexes exist outside of the brain. They're actually regulated by the brain stem.
I didn't know that, actually.
Well, it's how somebody can still be considered alive, even though their higher faculties are gone, because they still have reflexes.
It makes sense. I just never really thought about it that way.
But, well, may I describe how a reflex works?
Please.
So, basically, you have a receptor nerve ending that detects, in this case, in your throat, detects some sort of object or intrusion that shouldn't be there.
Like a sword.
Basically, the only stuff that should be there is fluid and chewed food.
Yeah.
As far as your receptors are concerned. But yes, if a sword or any other metal object makes its way into your throat, the receptors are going to figure this out, and they're going to send an electrical impulse to your central nervous system in the brainstem. The integration center is what it's called.
Yeah, that's kind of like it's... kind of sounded to me like a call center, like literally. I mean, it happens so quick, but it's like, what's the nature of your emergency, sir?
Exactly.
You're like, I've got a sword in my throat.
But this is the brain stem, so it's all done on like punch cards, like they used to play tic-tac-toe in the 70s.
Hanging chads.
Your brain stem says, oh, okay, well, there shouldn't be a metal object there. Let's just go ahead and direct the muscles of the throat to gag. And that produces what's called a retch. Mm-hmm. And that's meant to expel the foreign object.
Yeah.
What sword swallowers do is mute or dull this reflex so that it doesn't happen at all. And they do it by setting it off time after time after time.
Unbelievable. They make themselves gag as much as they can until it doesn't work.
Yeah.
Which is dangerous.
It's very dangerous. Yeah. And if you didn't get the idea before from the initial COA, sword swallowing is a very, very dangerous pastime, profession, whatever you're using it for.
I would imagine they're at a higher risk for choking.
Choking? Yeah, because the point of the gag reflex is to get that stuff out.
That piece of steak comes flying out when you retch it up.
Yes. And
ideally.
If you don't have a gag reflex, then yeah, that's bad news. Because that steak just stays in there and you die. You know, I had a friend who, when I was in elementary school, his mom got an emergency tracheotomy with a steak knife.
Oh, yeah?
Yep.
God, you always hear about those stories.
She had the little scar and everything.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Someone in a restaurant?
Doctor.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Gave her a steak knife.
Yeah.
No anesthesia, no nothing. Steak knife and then a straw or a pen.
Jeez.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything good like that happen.
I didn't see it happen.
Yeah, but I mean, I've never seen any like awesome life-saving situation.
Yeah.
I want to be a part of one one day. Just not on the steak side. So what other dangers? They actually did a study they won an Ig Nobel Prize for this study, I found out, in 2007.
Yeah.
And they studied 110 English-speaking sword swallowers and basically just asked them a bunch of questions about their health. And they called it sword throat when they get a sore throat.
Yeah.
Thought that was kind of clever.
It is very clever.
So throat pain, lower chest pain, persistent lower chest pain, internal bleeding occasionally.
Yeah.
I saw this one lady who was coughing up blood and they found out that she had like nicked part of her esophagus way down.
Ugh.
Which I imagine is common. Esophageal perforations like we just talked about. How do you say that? Pleurisy?
Pleurisy.
Pleurisy, inflammation of the lungs, and pericarditis, which is inflammation of the sac that protects the heart. And that's in descending order of how often those things happened.
Yeah.
So everyone gets the sword throat, it seems like, but probably very few actually got inflammation of the pericardium.
Right. They also figured out that there was a trend among sword swallowers where if they had a particularly rough performance, the inflammation that would resulted in further injury. So like they would be okay during the performance, but you know, they had a little trouble getting it down, but then a day later or something, they broke their esophagus or something like that.
Oh, really?
And then also apparently sinus infections are common because you're passing the sword with petroleum jelly and whatever hair and gunk it picked up in between the time you put the petroleum jelly on and the time you swallowed it.
Uh-huh.
Right. Past the sinuses, which can be sensitive, I can attest.
And I imagine a circus sideshow isn't the cleanest area on the planet.
You, I think, imagine correctly.
You know what I'm saying?
There's also death is a side effect of sword swallowing from time to time. Another British Medical Journal study cited the death of a man who swallowed an umbrella, or tried to, and died.
My first question was, did he accidentally try and open it? Yeah. He hit the button.
It's like Tom and Jerry.
Yeah, totally. And his body flares out like an umbrella.
Right. It's like Tom and Jerry, except real life and sad.
That's right.
Yeah.
World Sword Swallowers Day, 2010. What it sounds like is that they gathered sword swallowers at Ripley's Believe It or Nots all over the country.
Okay.
To do this all at once, to perform. And Red Stewart, your buddy Red, he swallowed a world record 52 swords at a time.
Oh, man.
And I don't know if that's official or unofficial Guinness certified, but George the Giant swallowed a 37-inch sword at the Hollywood, believe it or not.
Jeez.
So that's, they recommend 24 inches max because you're in the stomach. It's 37 inches.
That's longer than 3 feet.
That's crazy. Dan Meyer swallowed a giant straight razor. And hedge clippers in Dallas, at the Believe It or Not there. Travis Fessler swallowed a sword with cockroaches crawling around it, crawling on the sword. And it's guess where weird. This one happened?
Where?
Gatlinburg.
Oh, yeah?
Tennessee.
Wow.
What else? 120-degree curved sword at the Ripley's, believe it or not, in Ocean City,
wow,
Maryland. And
I'm just amazed over here.
I know. And finally, Mike Harrison at the Orlando, believe it or not, swallowed a sword that was driven down his throat by the discharge of a gun. I don't know how that happened, but...
Wait, what happened?
Apparently it was shot into his mouth from a gun. I don't know. I'd like to see that one.
Wow. Yeah, that's got to be on the internet.
Uh-huh.
Which has first killed and then now supports sword swallowing.
Right.
And also Red Stewart, who you mentioned, who swallowed 52 swords at once. I guess his former record was 25. But before that, this impresses me the most. He, in 1977, he swallowed a car axle.
Well, they do. Tracy pointed out people swallow dipsticks and other straight metal things.
Car axle.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing stuff.
Yeah, that's got to be pretty big around, too.
Yeah.
And people have swallowed snakes. I found this guy.
Oh, that sucks for the snake.
Yeah, I think the snake lives.
Yeah, but still, he's like...
Well, sure.
What are you doing?
Well, the snake is probably like, I'm getting eaten by another snake.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, okay, so it's just desserts then.
But this dude in the 1840s, Salamintro, the snake swallower,
mm-hmm.
he I have a couple of good quotes from him. They fancy that it hurts you, but it don't. Or what a fool I should be to do it. I don't mean to say it don't hurt you at first, because it do. For my swallow was very bad, and I couldn't eat anything but liquids for 2 months whilst I was learning. I cured my swallow whilst I was stretching it with lemon and sugar. And then he learned to swallow, that was swords, then he learned to swallow a snake, and said, the snakes are about 18 inches long, and you must first cut the stingers out, because it might hurt you. When I first began swallowing snakes, they tasted queer-like. They'd draw the roof of your mouth a bit. It's a roughish taste. Apparently the scales, like, it's easier going down than it is coming back up.
Oh, I could see that.
Just the way the scales are laying.
I could totally see that.
So we don't recommend swallowing snakes either. And I don't know if anyone still does that. That might be a 19th century...
Swallowing steaks? Snakes?
Gag.
Swallowing
oh, no.
steaks.
I swallow steaks a lot.
Yeah. It's not tough.
No.
Well, I guess that's it. You got anything else?
Nah.
Well, if you want to see some pretty cool images about sword swallowing with a strange, like, kind of superhero worshipy man.
He was buff, too.
Really,
did you notice
really
that?
Buff, yeah. There was a period around How Stuff Works where, like, comic book geeks, like, kind of ruled the place.
Right.
And so this was acceptable in some way.
Yeah, it was definitely looked different than our other illustrations.
Right. So if you want to see those weird illustrations and learn as much as you possibly can about sword swallowing and the circus arts in general, we have a whole circus arts section. Did you know that?
I just love you say circus arts.
Yeah. It's any of that stuff can be typed into the search bar at howstuffworks.com.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode called How Sword Swallowing Works, originally podcast at howstuffworks.com on September 27, 2011. You're tuned into the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast. Now for part two, Josh and Chuck examine lie detectors. This episode was originally podcast on September 1st, 2011.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. With me, as always, is Charles W. Chuck Bryant.
Liar.
You could tell. There's ways you can find out, Chuck.
Sure.
We'll get to that in a minute. This is Stuff You Should Know. Let me finish.
Okay.
And it's You Lie. Remember that guy?
Oh, yeah.
Joey Pants or whatever the congressman's name was?
Yeah, Saturday Night Live Joe had a funny skit that he had gotten a whole group of people to all stand up at once. Wasn't that the deal?
Yeah, tell it.
And, well, yeah, and he supposedly had a whole group of senators that were going to all stand up and yell, "You lie."
Mm-hmm.
And then he was the only one that did it.
Yeah.
That's
because he was out of the room when they were like, "No, we can't do that."
Yeah, I think that was it. That. That was funny.
Yeah. So we're talking about lie detectors, but let me take you back.
All right.
To a little place in time and space called the Jazz Age, early 1920s. Yeah. No, that's the Beatniks that did that.
Oh, okay. I'm sure a jazz person snapped their fingers at one point.
Sure.
Okay.
But not like that.
All right.
It was more like...
like Coltrane style?
Just like that.
Gotcha.
Anyway, this is 1921, Chuck, in Berkeley, California, at UCLA Berkeley. And there is a place there called the College Hall, which is a women's dorm. And in that year, there were a string of thefts, cash, rings, pretty much anything of value went missing for a little while there. And there's a man working at the Berkeley Police Department.
This is in the girls' dorm?
Yeah.
Okay.
Called College Hall.
Gotcha.
There's a man working in the Berkeley Police Department. His name is John Larson. And John Larson was the first cop ever to have a PhD. And he had gotten interested in this device called a cardiopneumopsychograph, which had been invented just a few years before by another guy named William Marston. And William Marston was a lawyer and a Harvard shrink. And he also, as an aside, created Wonder Woman with her lasso of truth.
Really?
He's the guy who invented what's now called the polygraph.
But What about the Wonder Woman? He created Wonder Woman, the character?
Yes. He was kind of a Renaissance man. But that's William Marston. John Larson works at the Berkeley Police Department, and he's become interested in this thing, the cardiopneumopsychograph,
mm-hmm.
and he realizes, okay, this is a perfect chance to apply it. So he rounds up, you know, some suspects. He does some normal police work and finds out who the suspects are in this hall.
Right.
And he rounds them up, brings them down to the station, and he starts hooking people up to this machine. And he gets to this one woman. Her name is Helen Graham. And
guilty.
Yes, pretty much is what he does. He goes, Ms. Graham, this machine is saying that you took the money. You know, did you? And he said that he noted on the machine a sharp drop in blood pressure, mm-hmm. followed by a sudden rise. And then after that, this woman flew into a rage. She tried to attack the machine.
Really?
She went crazy. So they basically string her along for a few days, and then finally she confesses. And it's the first time that a polygraph was ever used to solve a crime, ever.
That was probably the heyday, because before the people knew what it was, they could just say, this machine says that you're guilty, and they would be like, oh my God, how does it know?
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Very early on, some of the early proponents, specifically a guy named Leonard Keeler, recognized the placebo effect value before anyone knew there was a placebo effect, but the placebo effect value of a polygraph.
Yeah.
That just the idea, if you believed in this machine,
mm-hmm.
and that it could root out lies, then it could force you to confess just being hooked up to it.
Right.
You weren't going to pass it.
They should have called it the guilt box.
They called it the magic lie detector is one of the
really?
Things that they called it. Yeah, Leonard Keeler called it that. He worked with John Larson at the Berkeley Police Department, and eventually over time, John Larson saw what he considered the truth behind the lie detector and the fact that it kept being called lie detector, which is driving him crazy.
Yeah, sure.
And he eventually distanced himself from it later on in his career. But Leonard Keeler ran around marketing it to anyone and everyone, saying just having this
right.
is going to not only help you hire more truthful, forthright people, but it's going to keep them in line while they're working for you because they know you've got access to this thing and you can strap them to it at any time.
Wow.
Yep. So that's where the polygraph came from.
Yeah, there's a little prehistory, too, just to give them their due.
Yeah.
In 1895, Cesare Lombroso, he's an Italian criminologist. He measured changes in blood pressure for police cases.
Okay.
And in 1904, a device by Vittorio Benussi measured breathing. And so they were early 1900s, late 1800s, they were kind of on the scene of measuring these things. And Dr. James McKenzie in 1906 first mentioned the word polygraph with his instrument that he didn't use to root out the truth, but he did use it when giving medical examinations, though.
And then right before the polygraph was the unigraph.
Unigraph?
Which was part of what's still used today in the polygraph. It measured respiration.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. But then you add to it a couple of other things, and you got the polygraph.
We could stop here. This is interesting enough right now.
So there's no... really?
No.
There's no no one walking the planet who has anything to do with polygraphs that call them lie detectors. And anyone, even the most ardent defender of polygraph technology, would... correct you if you called it a lie detector. They would be like, it's not a lie detector.
Because you can't detect a lie. It's impossible.
The whole basis of a polygraph is that it is a set of medical instruments that you use to measure changes in things like your heart rate, your respiration, and sweatiness, basically.
Yeah, I would fail.
Well, a lot of people do fail, and we'll get to that. But because of your sweat?
Oh, yeah.
That's okay.
They would even hook me up. They'd just be like, dude.
You look so good.
Yeah, you're so sweaty right now.
When you're hooked up to this machine, the whole point is that it measures these physiological changes, and the idea that you're going to undergo a physiological change is based on the concept that a person hooked to this machine who is guilty will experience fear that they're going to be detected.
Right.
So this machine is designed to detect that fear.
That's right.
Which is really roundabout. But for a century almost, these things were used and abused. And it took a while for people to kind of catch on that there's a lot to criticize here with polygraphs.
Yeah, for sure. But they're still used. All right, so let's get into this. First of all, we need to point out that analog polygraphs are what you have long seen in movies and TV when they have the little jittery, looks like a seismograph on the paper scrolling by. And you're hooked up to all these different things on your chest and your forehead and your fingertips.
Yep.
These days, they do that digitally, but it's basically still the same technique.
Yeah.
They just don't use the little scrolling needle. Do they have a name for that? I'm sure
they do. It's called an ink-filled pen.
It is?
Yeah.
Okay. But the three things that they do, Josh, they measure your respiratory rate, as you said. They take pneumographs, which are rubber tubes filled with air, time around your chest and your abdomen, and that is going to measure whether or not you start breathing heavy, essentially, when you get nervous.
It monitors your breathing pattern and any changes to it, and it does it pretty cleverly, right?
Yeah, with bellows. They're filled with air, so when you breathe in real deeply or have a change, it's going to displace that into the bellows, and that will originally that was attached. The bellows were literally attached to the mechanical arm.
Right.
That showed the change. These days, it's a transducer that converts it digitally, electronically.
Right. It converts it to an electrical pattern, right?
Yeah, that probably just says why.
Virtually the same thing.
Yeah.
No, I think it looks a lot like it. If you look, there's a picture of a modern one, and the graph.
It's the same thing.
It looks just like it. But yeah, it's not a paper readout any longer.
Right.
Which is kind of interesting. Like, this technology hasn't changed on a very fundamental basis for like 100 years almost.
Yeah, I mean, the early one from McKinsey in 1906, they say that a lot of the same components are still very similar today.
Right. You also are going to have, so you're going to have two tubes, one around your chest, one around your abdomen. That's keeping an eye on your breathing.
Yes.
You're going to have a blood pressure cuff, which keeps an eye on your heart rate and your blood pressure. And it does it through sound, right?
Yeah, I didn't realize this.
So when the blood comes in and out of your veins, it creates sound, and sound can also be used to displace air, causing a bellows to contract, which, again, moved the arm on the scroll and now is created or turned into an electrical pattern.
Yeah.
But it's the same thing. But it's sound, which I just think is very neat.
Well, and what's also neat is the sweat one. I figured they would have some sort of like a moisturometer just to detect moisture, but it's called galvanic skin resistance, or GSR.
Or electrodermal activity.
That's right, and they hook up these finger plates to galvanometers, and they are basically measuring the skin's ability to conduct electricity, and if your skin is moist, it's going to be able to conduct electricity easier.
Yes.
And that's what they're measuring there.
It's like the ones, the little heart rate monitors that they clip to your fingertips in the hospital, but these things measure electricity instead.
Yes.
Which, if you are dry, you're going to conduct less electricity.
Yeah.
If you're wet, you're going to conduct more. So since you have so many pores on the end of your fingers and you sweat when you're nervous, there you go.
Done.
So you put all this together, and it paints this picture. It's the ACLU, among other people, have decried as just, what are you doing here? Basically, is what the ACLU says, right? what you have is a picture of a person who is undergoing stress,
mm-hmm.
maybe feeling embarrassment, is maybe just scared to be there, maybe doesn't like having things wrapped around his or her chest.
Yeah.
Maybe doesn't really like the person asking the questions.
Yeah.
The results of these changes in pattern, the data, is totally subjective.
That's right.
Which makes polygraphs totally subjective, which takes it in large part out of the realm of science.
Yeah, voodoo science is what they call it. And although proponents will say that a well-trained forensic psychophysiologist, which is the examiner, can get through all that to still get a good result.
Yes.
They're like, yeah, they know all this stuff. And if you're good, then you can factor that in and still get a good result.
So let's talk about what the forensic psychophysiologist does. There's apparently, I've seen anywhere between 5,000 and 10,000 of them in the U.S. at any given time.
Yeah.
And some of them belong to professional organizations. I think probably maybe half or a third, depending on where you are on that estimate.
Right.
Belong to any number of professional organizations. Some have no accreditation whatsoever, but are still able to open up shops depending on the state they're in. Some states have zero laws about being a forensic psychophysiologist, a.k.a. a polygraph examiner.
That's right.
But there is also some, there are programs out there. Who wrote this article? Kevin Bonser?
I don't know.
I think so. He interviewed a guy who founded the Exiton Academy. Exiton is a manufacturer of polygraphs.
Right.
And they founded this academy as well, where you go through a certain amount of training to become a forensic psychophysiologist.
And he actually interviewed that guy?
Yeah. His name's Bob Lee.
That's Lee?
Lee. And Lee says that if you come to their academy, you have to have a baccalaureate degree, a bachelor's, right? Or you have to have at least 5 years investigative experience and an associate's degree. You have to take a 10-week course. And after you complete the 10-week course, you have to carry out 25 polygraph examinations and submit them to be reviewed. So these are like real-life ones. I guess you're working with your local police department or whatever. Maybe you're already a cop. And you have to submit it to the Accident Academy board for a review. And then once they're all reviewed and everybody's all thumbs up, you are a licensed, I guess. But you're not licensed because there's no licensing body.
Yeah.
You graduate, I guess is what they call it.
Right.
So that's as accredited as it gets, I guess. And like you said, proponents of polygraph testing say that if you're a good FP,
right,
you're going to be able to structure everything correctly so that you can see past somebody who sweats a lot like you,
sure,
or who gets stressed out easily like me, and design your questions appropriately, and you're going to be able to figure out whether this person is deceptive or not.
Yeah.
So how would you do that, Chuck?
Well, we should talk about the test itself, I guess. You're gonna go in and you're gonna get a pretest before you get strapped up to anything.
Right.
Could take about an hour. This is just you and those are the only two people in the room. You're not surrounded by folks like in the movies and stuff.
Yeah.
Although in the movie sometimes it's just two people, I guess. But the pretest, you're just gonna get an interview basically about why you're being investigated. They're also gonna be profiling you and checking you out and just seeing what kind of questions you respond to and what might make you nervous, just so they'll be better informed about how to properly question you once you're all strapped in.
Right, and the pretest, when you're just kind of hanging out with them casually, the examiner is also kind of getting info out of you that you might not be aware of. Like, if you are, if you talk leisurely about your favorite beer at one point and how you like it a lot, and then later on, it also comes up that you have to drive a lot. They might use that for a control question, which could be something like, have you ever driven under the influence of alcohol? And a control question is something where you would have to admit guilt, and you may not want to, but it's such a broad question that just about anybody is guilty of it. Like, have you ever lied to somebody? Have you ever, stolen anything? That kind of thing. to where if you say no, they now have a baseline for what it looks like when you lie, that they can make a reasonable assumption that you have just lied, and any of the data captured on the polygraph, they're going to use to analyze everything else off of.
And that's pretty much it. That's the test. And afterward, you have the post-test where they look at all the data and chart out whether or not they think you're deceptive and where. Like on this question, you were deceptive. On this question, you may have been deceptive. It's kind of hard to tell. On this one, you definitely were deceptive. So,
and it's all in relation to that control question, that baseline, right?
Yeah.
So if on questions where, I mean, they're going to have to talk to the police as well, too, and say, what do you want to know out of this person? So they'll design questions around that as well. So they may have a question like, are you wearing a blue shirt? That may be question one. That's irrelevant, right?
Right.
Question two is, have you ever lied to your boss? That's the control question. And then question three is something like, you know, did you steal the cookie from the cookie jar? Like, that's the one that the cops want them to ask.
Right.
They'll compare the results of Q3 against Q2. And if they're the same or you can't really tell, that's an inconclusive test.
Right.
So that's it. I mean, like you said, that's polygraph.
Pretty easy.
It is. It's jarringly easy considering that it's used in legal cases a lot, right?
Yes, that's true. People try to battle the lie detector in various ways. There are little tricks that the internet says works, like taking a sedative or putting antiperspirant on your fingers, which it seems like they would make you wash your hands, putting a tack in your shoe, and anytime you get asked a question, every single time you stomp on the tack, and the idea is that you're just going to skew the test so they all look the same.
Yeah.
So your body has the same reaction no matter what's going on.
I guess if you press on the tack, your physiological response could overwhelm any response to the question, right?
Exactly.
Like I said, these things are used in legal cases, but with caveats, right? If you undergo a polygraph, whether you fail or pass, it doesn't really matter, legally speaking.
Right.
Unless you're in New Mexico.
Yeah, this is the only state that allows it.
Just openly, like if you take a polygraph, like it's admissible in court.
Yeah.
Every other state, usually the both sides have to agree on it being admitted, or the judge has to say, yeah, we're going to admit this one, right?
Yeah, and federally, the judge decides whether or not they're going to admit it.
Right, and I guess state judges kind of follow that federal ruling of polygraphing.
Yeah, and it's sort of a crapshoot if a federal judge is going to allow it or not. There's no precedent really to where they say we have to or we don't have to.
Right. So what are the problems with this? The problems with a polygraph are that it's subjective, right? That's a big one.
Mm-hmm.
But also because it's subjective, you can get what are called false positives and false negatives.
Yeah, and you don't want that because then the test itself is just not valid.
Right. But I mean, a lot of people use that as evidence that polygraphy
shouldn't be done at all.
That it's not valid.
Yeah.
False positive in polygraphing is when you find somebody who is deemed deceptive but was telling the truth. False negative is when somebody who wasn't telling the truth is deemed truthful.
Right.
Like Gary Ridgway, the Green River Killer.
Mm-hmm.
They had him for a little while and gave him a polygraph, and he passed, and they let him go, and he went and killed a bunch more women. All right?
That's right. I didn't know that, actually.
Yeah.
Well, good for him. there's also the federal government is the largest consumer of these exams, and if you work for the federal government, you've probably had one to get the job. But you can't do that in the private sector thanks to the Polygraph Protection Act, Employee Polygraph Protection Act in the late 80s. They said, you can't force your employees to do this. You can request it. But if they don't want to do it, you can't fire them because of it. You just can't do it.
Right.
Not in private land.
Right. Unless you have a contract with the government, and then that's not valid.
Right.
But yeah, the federal government is the largest opponent to them in court. but also the largest consumer.
Imagine that.
And there's been a lot of cases that shaped its admissibility or not, but the polygraph, it seems like it's kind of on its way out. I wrote an article about MRI being used as lie detectors.
Oh, really?
And that's starting to kind of come into fashion the more we start to understand like how lies are born in the brain.
Yeah.
Being able to see it and saying, this is the pattern that will happen if this person's lying. And then that pattern happens, they say, well, we know you're lying. We just saw that lie form in your brain.
That makes sense.
Yes, but at the same time, people who understand MRIs say it is way too early to be doing that. And even if we can do it with 100% accuracy, there are a lot of moral and ethical questions to it as well that
right.
we need to address first.
Always.
And then penile plethysmography.
What's that?
So remember the pneumographs that go around the chest and the abdomen?
Mm-hmm.
Imagine one of those that goes around the penis, and it does the same thing. It detects changes in contraction and girth. That's a perfect way to put it.
Yeah, wow.
And it's used to detect arousal. They use it for sex offenders. It's under at least as much attack as regular polygraphs. But there, I wrote this blog post called Using Science to Root Out Latent Homosexuality Among Homophobes.
Yeah.
A study at UGA used penile plethysmography to find if anyone who they had deemed homophobic became aroused when exposed to homosexual pornography.
Wow.
Yeah, it's one of the better posts I've ever written.
Jeez.
I think.
All right, that's our future, I guess.
Penile plethysmography for everyone.
Maybe.
For
everyone with a penis, at least.
And then, Chuck, lastly, I want to encourage everybody, if this has piqued your interest about lie detectors,
mm-hmm.
to go watch the Shoe Court Shoe Store job interview clip from Mr. Show on YouTube.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
That was very good. With our friend Paul F. Tompkins in it. He has a breakthrough.
Oh, was he in that one?
Yeah. Yeah.
Good old PFT.
Yep. And that's it for lie detectors, right?
Yeah, I want to take a test. If there's someone in the Atlanta area that administers these and would be willing to give me a lie detector test, I would love to do that.
Okay. And I'll watch.
Yes.
As
long as I can, you know, approve the questions.
Yes.
Or not approve them, but I don't want to be, like, rooted out as some miscreant.
It's a little late for that, Chuck.
Just keep it above board.
If you want to know more about lie detectors and play with some lie detector flash animation, you can do that by typing in lie detector on the in the search bar on howstuffworks.com. And that means it's time for listener mail.
That's right, Josh. This is from Brad. And Brad, if you remember, we had a list of suggestions from a listener not too long ago that thought our podcast could be a lot better if we changed a few things. Brad has some suggestions of his own of how we can make the podcast better. We should both have nicknames.
We do.
Zazz up the actual name, like Welcome to Stuff You Should Know with JC and the Dingo. Sit back while getting a big helping of knowledge from Chucko and the Duck. I second the suggestion to remove the personal anecdotes. Should be moved to a separate podcast called The Josh and Chuck Memoirs. Daily one-hour podcast can recount your lives from birth to present, focusing on depressing stories that are marginally factual.
It's in development.
It is. Chuck, please raise your voice one octave. Josh, lower yours one octave.
What?
Okay, so now this is how I talk.
I talk like this.
The opening of the podcast should be a description of what each of you ate that day and the number of trips to the bathroom.
Seven.
This allows the listener to keep track at home. Hedgehogs, brain surgeons, arcades, and Bolivian politics are underrepresented on your podcast. At least 20% should be about these subjects. Do not exclude listener mail. Instead, create a quieter audio track reading the listener mail and overlay it on the rest of the podcast. That way, listeners can hear both the mail and the main content at the same time.
That's a pretty good idea.
Why not set the podcast?
We would literally drive people insane if we did that.
Why not set the podcast to a backdrop of tribal drums and jungle animal noises? It would give it an exotic feel.
That's over the listener mail track?
Over the whole thing.
So that'd be three tracks deep.
Yes. And it would lead to suspense for the listener to wonder if you will be eaten by jaguars. And it was clear from the podcast on mummies, neither of you had ever been mummified. Please refrain from explaining topics that you don't have personal experience with. And then the final suggestion, just retell episodes of This American Life.
That last one went down like the Dave Letterman top 10 list.
So that's Brad.
Thanks, Brad. Those are all great ideas.
Tongue-in-cheek.
I like three tracks all in one, streaming at once together.
Listener mail quietly, the podcast, and tribal drumming.
Yes, and jungle noises.
Yes.
Let's see. If you have access to a polygraph and want to hook Chuck up to it, let us know.
Yeah.
You can let us know on Facebook at facebook.com/stuffyoushouldknow. You can tweet to us at SYSK Podcast. And you can send us a regular old email at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode called How Lie Detectors Work, originally podcast at howstuffworks.com on September 1st, 2011. You can subscribe to Stuff You Should Know and other podcasts at howstuffworks.com as well as on iTunes. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Ah, come on, baby, don't. when the sax solo starts, that's when I start talking over the instrumental. Downtown Soulville Show, Mr. Fine Wine here on WFMU. Back after a week away, I want to thank Betsy for filling in at the last minute last week. Heroic effort. Betsy, thank you very much. Lots of great Soul 45s for you tonight. If you're tuning in for the first time, the way this works is I carry in a box of 45s from my collection, try not to lose them on the subway, and then play them for you with very little fanfare, no frills, just music. 201-200-WFMU, the number to call to reach me. You can email me at finewine@wfmu.org. Soul 45s on a Friday night. Stay tuned.